The Lord be with you. You're listening to a podcast from the teaching ministry of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. For more multimedia content or to get more information, go to www.epiclesis.org. Now, here's Pastor Chris.
Well, hi, folks, and welcome back to another Sunday morning teaching from Epiclesis, an ancient future faith church in Sacramento, California. I'm Chris Alford, the pastor. Dallas Willard one time asked, how many people are radically and permanently repelled from the way by Christians who are unfeeling, stiff, unapproachable, boringly lifeless, obsessive, and dissatisfied? Yet such Christians are everywhere. In this particular sermon, Dr. J. Dudley asks the question, well, did Jesus have joy? Was he fun? What about his life and ministry? What can we learn about that as we, as Jay said, make Jesus the leader of our emotional lives? Join us, and the Lord be with you.
I'm going to divulge a family secret. A decade or so ago, we bought a brand new car. It's that white van that we drive all around. We'd never bought a new car before, and so we got a new license plate with it, and it had a whole bunch of numbers on it and three letters. And we thought, white generic van and park, you see them all over the place. How are we going to ever pick out our car in a parking lot? So I said, well, because those middle letters are ACJ, if we could come up with an acronym for that, we could remember it and find our car. And Chris says, I know, ACJ, always cerebral J. Well, that has stuck. And ACJ, that's what that means, always cerebral J. Now, Epiclesis sponsors a Trail Life Troop, which is an explicit Christian ministry to boys and dads. And it's all about having adventure and learning leadership and skills and stuff so you can become a really good Christian man when you grow up. That's a very brief way to say it. And I happen to be chaplain of that troop. And I rarely miss a Friday night meeting, and so I know what goes on. At the end of almost every meeting, you have 40 or 50 boys standing at attention. Well, they're standing there, and their troop is all formed up in a square, and Troop Master Brian Engel will say, did you all have fun? And they'll go, yeah! They will. They yell it because they did. They did. They played silly games. They horsed around because boys will be boys in the Trail Life. We let boys be boys. And sometimes you have to rein it in, but you know, sometimes you just kind of let it loose. They learn about the Christian faith. They learn about the American flag. They learn manners, all kinds of stuff going on, and vigorous discussions, age level appropriate all the time. And one Friday last spring, Brian asked the question, did you have fun? And I'm standing behind him, being my cerebral self, and asking, sounds like fun is the main thing. Is it really? It's an attractor strategy, and it's a retention strategy. I mean, you gotta do fun things or these boys don't come back. So I get it from that standpoint, but is it appropriate to suggest that fun is the main point? Are fun and good times something we're adding artificially, or is it really there in the Christian faith and life, really? And this whole internal dialogue reminded me of Mrs. McGillicuddy. That's not her real name, but she's a real person. And this conversation really happened. Mrs. McGillicuddy was the president of the local WCTU. And for those of you who are younger and don't know what that stands for, it stands for the Women's Christian Temperance Union. But they didn't promote temperance, which is moderation. They promoted total abstinence from alcohol and women's suffrage and a whole bunch of other stuff. And it's good stuff. And they're a strong group and they still exist. And they were basically the primary force between the 18th Amendment. Is that the amendment that outlawed alcohol? And they had and still have local chapters in some churches. And Mrs. McGillicuddy and her daughter were helping set up the meeting of the WCTU that night. The daughter is about 30 years old at the time. And she was thinking, and she had to talk, and they were talking all about this, the total abstinence piece, and And the daughter said, but mom, Jesus made wine at the wedding at Cana. Yes, she said, but he never should have done it.
Oh my.
But the daughter was on the right track when she said, but mom, Jesus. Yeah. Yeah. So, to find out if anything is real or authentic in the Christian faith and life, you have to go to Jesus. For Mrs. McGillicuddy, Jesus was the problem. Man, if Jesus is your problem, you've really got a problem. So let's follow the daughter's lead here. Let's say, but Jesus, did Jesus ever have any fun? Did Jesus enjoy? Let's look at the scriptures. Now, I'll be the first to say, I want to be the first to say, that there's nothing explicit on this subject in the Gospels. No explicit answer. You never find a statement like, Jesus laughed, or Jesus chortled, or Jesus snickered, or anything like that. You don't find it. But there's some very interesting stuff underneath the surface. And that's where I want us to look today, under the surface of the Gospels. So, but here's the basic foundational truth, and I'm reading for freshness from the Phillips translation of the Gospel of John. At the beginning, God expressed himself. That personal expression, that word, was with God and was God and existed with God from the beginning. All creation took place through him, and none took place without him. In him appeared life, and this life was the light of mankind. The light still shines in the darkness, and the darkness has never put it out. So the Word of God became a human being and lived among us. We saw his splendor, the splendor of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. Man. So, the Word of God became a human being with skin, with nerve endings, with taste buds, with a beating heart, and good eyes and good ears, and a brain with firing synapses. He knew sights and sounds and sensations and emotions and the feel of things like water, like wood, like cloth, and affection. So let's begin at Luke chapter 2, verse 47. It's important for us to read these things, to hear these things again. Luke chapter 2. You know what happens here. They went to the feast in Jerusalem, and Jesus gets left behind, and they find him in the temple 3 days later. It's this extraordinary story. But in verse 47, where they find him, well, verse 46, after 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. He's listening, and all he's doing is asking questions. And everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. At age 12, Jesus is asking astonishing, impressive questions. And people are amazed at his insight that comes from even asking the questions. The pleasure of amazing other people is real. My last congregation, I took a couple of boys to the field archery range in El Dorado Hills. Field archery is like golf. You shoot at different targets from different ranges and different angles and so on and so forth. And on the second or third stand, that's what you'd call it in archery, the boys were standing right with me, and I just picked up and shot 50 feet down here, and the arrow went right in the center of that target. And those boys went, because they thought that preachers just, you know, they just study the Bible and they preach and they pray and they stuff like that. They don't know how to do anything. So the bullseye at 50 feet caused their jaws to drop, and you know what? It felt pretty good. The pleasure of amazing other people. And Jesus asking questions that were amazing. Okay, Mark chapter 1, 9 to 11. We're going to do a quick survey of Jesus' life here. Mark chapter 1, verses 9 to 11. At that time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. As Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." Have you ever known the pleasure of being pleasing to someone who was utterly important to you? Jesus knows that pleasure. Moving right along to John chapter 2. This is the chapter that Mrs. McGillicuddy had such a hard time with. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Oh, man, this slays me. I have checked every commentary in the whole world. Now, that's a slight exaggeration, but every commentator I have ever checked with on this, they say that when Jesus says, "Why do you involve me?" That's how it's translated. Verse 4, it's actually an idiom that literally, you translate it literally, it's "what you mean." What you mean. And I think to myself, okay, what if Christy Fakincher sees a need that Nathan can help out with? And she goes to Nathan and she says, "You could help with this." And Nathan says, "What you mean? What's your connection with me? What? How would that go over? How would that go over if Nathan repudiated his mother?" Not too well, right? Because what's the answer? What is the what you mean? Jesus wouldn't be a human being without Mary. What are you talking about? And what do you mean he said no and then went and did what she wanted? What? That makes no sense. What if he was teasing? What if he was saying, "What you mean? Like, everything? I mean, everything human about me is from you?" What if he's just teasing her and just messing with her, like boys do with their mothers? "You should see my grandson messing with my daughter-in-law. It is so funny." And you know what? She loves it. She loves it. He can mess with her. Oh, it's so funny. He's very good at it. And she loves it when he does that. Anyway, I'm just talking about this human stuff. If he's just teasing her, and then he goes off and does exactly what she wants. Now that makes sense. Doesn't it make sense? Otherwise, you have this. Otherwise, you got Jesus going, "Huh? What? No, not now." And then going off and doing it. Oh, makes no sense. All the commentators are wrong. I'm right. The other fun part of this is that, remember what happens when the water actually becomes wine? What's the reaction? The bridegroom can't explain it. The servants can't explain it. There's this bewilderment. And I don't, how could you do that? How could Jesus do that without at least cracking a smile? I mean, he knows, nobody knows, it's funny. It's funny that he just kind of, he never explains it, he just does it, and it happens, and nobody really knows but him. And when the master of ceremonies comes to the bridegroom and says, "What is this? This is the best, you're doing it in reverse." The bridegroom can't explain it. I just think it's funny, in a mild sort of chuckling sort of way. All right, Mark chapter 3. I'll just confess, this is my favorite story in all the Gospels. Mark chapter 3. It goes by very quickly. Mark chapter 3. You know that there were rules against healing on the Sabbath in Jesus' time. That was forbidden, verboten, don't do it. It's work, it's sin, don't do it. Well, there's this guy with a withered hand in the synagogue at night. Man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. You jerks. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Yeah, I think everybody's jaw dropped. It's like, what's he going to do? Stand up in front of everyone. Then Jesus asked them, "What is lawful on the Sabbath? To do good or to do evil? To save life or to kill?" But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. He said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out. If Jesus said to you, "Stretch out your ugly, wizened up hand," would you do it? Yeah, you would do it because command. I mean, you feel the authority. It's almost like you don't have a choice. But, oh yeah, except we might get in trouble. Stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. And Jesus, I know, he's angry. He is. But for a minute there, for a moment, he had the pleasure of seeing that hand that was wizened up and shriveled open right up and strengthen again. It'd be like seeing a prune become a plum again. What a delight. What a delight. Oh, my goodness. Forbidden healing. Going against the rules, going against these jerks that are going to plot to kill him because he did this. This is why John Eldridge calls Jesus the beautiful outlaw. And that's what he is. If you go a little farther on, in the Gospel of Luke 7, chapter 7, chapter 7, verse 31, Jesus speaking here, and he says, "To what then can I compare the people of this generation? What are they like? They are like children sitting in the marketplace calling out to each other, 'We played the flute for you and you did not dance. We sang a dirge and you did not cry.' For John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine." He belonged to the WCTU, I guess. "And you say he has a demon. The Son of Man comes eating and drinking, and you say he is a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. But wisdom is justified by all her children." You talk about sarcasm. There it is. You guys are totally irrational hypocrites, but your conclusions are always right. It's essentially what he's saying. You don't like John because he was an abstainer. You don't like me because I associate with outcasts. That's true. He associated with outcasts, with the not very good people. Do you know those kind of people? Do you know that they don't put up with stuffed shirts? They don't put up with phony stuff. They don't put up with stiff, lifeless, boring religious experts. They just won't tolerate it. How did Jesus make it with these people? Because he was genial. He was approachable. He wasn't a stilted, boring, dull know-it-all. He had a good time with them, or they wouldn't have hung around him. He was wonderful to be with, or they wouldn't have been with him. Okay, Mark chapter 6. You know what happened after the feeding of the 5,000. Remember, he sent the disciples away? Sent them off the boat and wanted to be by himself for a while. Sent them off, and away they went. And he had some time alone. And then we come to verse 47. When evening came, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. About the fourth watch of the night, he went out to them, walking on the lake. Let's stop right there. What? Walking on the lake? Have you ever tried that? Can you imagine doing that? Can you imagine? You're walking along and you don't sink. You're just walking along like you're walking on carpet. Right over the waves. Woo! Fun. The closest I've come to that is surfing. And I'm telling you, that's one of the biggest thrills in the natural world, is getting caught in a wave on a surfboard. But Jesus is walking. Nobody ever did that before. Never. Never. How can that not be fun? And here's the other thing. Here's the other thing. I know it's not explicit. I know it's not. But here's the other piece of this. The disciples, when they see him coming, what do they quite naturally and reasonably assume? This is tough. Wind, rowing against the wind, you're getting spray, you're getting water, you're getting cold. I've been there. It's overwhelming. You think the whole world, universe is against you. It's just awful. And then you see this figure approaching on the water. What could it be if it doesn't sink? A ghost. A ghost, of course. That's the only reasonable explanation. The disciples are scared spitless. I mean, come on. Wind, water, freezing cold, working like crazy. You're not even sure you're going to survive it. And then, look out there. What is that? It could only be a ghost. There's no way that Jesus could do this without scaring them. No way. He couldn't do it. But wasn't it fun? I mean, you know, really, I think he can't do it without scaring them. He finally says to them, hey, it's me. Don't worry. Don't sweat it. Paraphrase. Okay. Matthew 22. This is serious. Matthew 22. This is another famous passage. See, I've been working on this my whole adult life, I guess. This is so great. We need an hour to go through Matthew 22. But I'll briefly just try to set it up for you. See, the Pharisees try to trap him about the then hot topic of paying taxes to Caesar. That was a big, talk about political, that was a real big deal. Because some said you should, and some said you shouldn't, and they try to trap him, and he gives this incredible answer. Whose image is stamped on the coin? Okay, so give to God what's God's and man. Caesar what's Caesar's and to God what's God. Referring to the image of God in us. Whew! Brilliant, brilliant. Oh. And devastating to the Pharisees. So, okay, the Pharisees get bested by Jesus and the Sadducees come up. And they try to make the resurrection look ridiculous. And Jesus wipes them out. And then the Pharisees, hearing that Jesus had silenced the Pharisees come back for another round. And that's all about what's the greatest law and so forth. And Jesus silences that whole thing. And then look out, because Jesus has a question. Look out. Here it is, Matthew 22, verse 41. While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, what do you think about the Christ, Messiah? Whose son is he?
The son of David, they replied.
He said to them, well, how is it then that David, speaking by the Spirit, calls him Lord? For he says, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. And here comes the question. If then David calls him Lord, how can he be his son? No one could say a word in reply. And from that day on, no one dared to ask him any more questions. I think that was pretty fun. Pretty fun for Jesus. And he leaves it hanging there, unresolved, Pastor. He didn't help him. He just left him hanging there like a pretzel. Just, I don't get it. I don't know what he's talking about. A couple more. John 20, verse 26. John chapter 20, verse 26. This is a sleeper, you guys. This is a real sleeper. John 20, 26. We're getting to the sad part here a little bit. Wrong verse. It's John 19, 23. 1923. When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes, dividing them into four shares, one for each of them, with the undergarment remaining. This garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. Let's not tear it, they said to one another. Let's decide by lot who will get it. And this happened that the scripture might be fulfilled, which said, they divided my garments among them, and cast lots for my clothing. So this is what the soldiers did. I want to just put a quick spotlight on that seamless undergarment. Why didn't they want to divide it up? Because it was a seamless garment. Very expensive. Was it a gift? Is it something he earned and bought for himself? I don't know. But you could ask a kind of a Judas kind of question, like, well, why was that? Why did he wear that fancy thing? Why didn't he just sell that and give the money to the poor? Well, because he liked it. He enjoyed the feeling, the pleasure of wearing a very expensive garment that touched his skin. Now, here comes the best one of all. John chapter 20, verse 1. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary of Magdala went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, they've taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they've put him. This morning is a very expanded version of the talk I gave Friday night at Trail Life. And I asked the boys, I said, why was the stone rolled away? And this little five-year-old, the youngest group, brand new kid, he goes, so the disciples could get in and see that he was gone. 5 years old? I know adults that don't understand this. It was awesome. That little kid was right on, and I told him, that is right on, dude. Talking kid language. And his trail guide went over and slapped him on the back. Like, great answer, man. Cool. Such a cool thing. Do you understand that that stone wasn't rolled away so Jesus could get out? It was rolled away so we could get in and see what had happened. He got out of there before that stone ever moved. And what I was thinking about this week was the old gospel song. I'm going to change one word. This tomb is not my home. I'm just a passing through. How did he do that? Well, don't you have to ask that about everything that he did? Like the wine and the walking on the water and the healing the withered hand. How did he do that? I don't know. But he did. And How could you go out of that tomb without opening anything up and it not be fun? Like a pleasure. Like, whoa! And, you know, a week later, the disciples are still afraid. The Jews, everything's still crazy. The disciples are behind locked doors for fear. And what does Jesus do? He shows up. The lock is not a problem. The door is not a problem. The windows aren't a problem. No problem. He just, hi, guys. I'm sorry, I'm being vernacular. And then one more really cool one. Luke 24, this is that same day, that same resurrection day. Now that same day, two of them were going into a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. And as they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. Gotta be kind of fun. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one living in Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have happened here in these days?" Like, what things? Yeah. Ah, what a fun question. What a blast to ask that question. Just saying that, just asking that question, what things, as if he didn't know. Ah, so much fun. So, we have surveyed some of the delights of being Jesus. But what importance is it? First of all, if you're a crabby Christian, if you're no fun to be around, if you don't have a deeply satisfying, fun life, Jesus is not the problem. Dallas Willard raises this question: how many people are radically and permanently repelled from the way by Christians who are unfeeling, stiff, unapproachable, boringly lifeless, obsessive, and dissatisfied? Yet such Christians are everywhere. Mark Twain knew a lot of them. That's why he advised, "Go to heaven for the climate and hell for the company." Kind of offensive, actually, but, you know, he's got a point. So just a couple of paragraphs. Mark Lee, president of Simpson College, the guy with the bald head preaching in the Philippines. "My father-in-law was a pious man. He daily completed full spiritual ablutions. He was a faithful churchgoer, a man of prayer and Bible study. He would bear witness to his non-Christians about his faith, but most persons evaded discussion with him on religious issues. He often gave the illusion of being lonely and judgmental. On occasion, he asked me forlorn questions about himself. He felt something of a failure, but I never found any willingness in myself to tell him what I thought about his life. He was humorless. He did not want to be humorless, but he couldn't find he couldn't find it in himself to bend. Everything in the world about him was forever threatening. Franklin Roosevelt had been a curse to the country. The world was going to hell post-haste. We never had a clear definition of this. His children did not know easy banter with their father. His wife maintained his careful regimen with him. She did her duty and kept down her lightness of spirit. When she released it, she felt guilty and hid within herself. Was this the proper life of the proper Christian? Not really. Somewhere in the course of his life, my father-in-law made a turn away from the impulse for joy. His accent in life became a trudging daily experience. One takes that pattern when his eyes are constantly cast downward, seeing only the problems, the monotony, the narrow shaft of time. Joy is looking up, seeing the stars, God, and ultimate victory. Humor and faith conclude that the large picture, not the small, is real. At the center of that big picture is Jesus. Not only is he not the problem, he is the solution to the problem. What would have happened if Mark Lee's father-in-law had found what we examined this morning? What if he saw that Jesus had good times and great pleasures here among us? Perhaps that discovery would have enabled him to let Jesus be the emotional leader of his life. What would happen if you did? What would happen if I did? I'm trying, because I'm a very serious fellow. And I'm working on it. But in sum, here it is. For me, at least. Jesus enjoying his life, his earthly life, gives me permission to enjoy my earthly life.
You've been listening to a podcast from Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. If you'd like to learn more about ancient future faith or worship with us at Epiclesis, visit us on the web at www.epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you.